Yes, Natasha Mitchell joining you now on RN. A very good morning to you. The stalkers landed. Babies. Well, one baby boy in particular seems to be occupying the headlines this morning. Much happy speculation over the name of the new royal heir. I have to say I was struck by the curious contrast to last week's headlines about the need to name the nameless baby who drowned off the coast of Christmas Island. Such are the contrasts in our headlines. Picking up on the asylum seeker story in just a moment on the show, in fact. Also, with the axing of the carbon tax and the move towards an emissions trading scheme with a floating carbon price, what's the deal for your electricity bill? And we're also singing up a storm with the national songwriting competition for students later on in the show too, with hits from Oscar and the Grouches and songs like Puppy Dog Eyes and Rex Eating Biscuits. Well, the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, believes he's found the solution to the increasing number of asylum seekers making their way to Australia by boat. The new policy is that every person who attempts to arrive here by boat will be sent to Papua New Guinea, where they will be processed and, if found to be genuine refugees, settled there, not here. So no asylum seeker who arrives by boat in the future will be able to live in Australia, according to this, well, dramatic new policy. Will this zero-tolerance approach work, though? My first guest this morning argues that Australia would benefit from looking at the asylum seeker issue through the prism of our response to the illicit drug issue. There are striking parallels, he says. Professor Desmond Manderson is a future fellow at the ANU's College of Law. He's the author of From Big Mr. Sin to Mr. Big, A History of Australian Drug Laws. His provocative essay in the coming Griffith Review is titled Groundhog Day, Why the Asylum Problem is Like the Drug Problem. Welcome, Des.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Look, in this essay you're making a comparison between how we talk about asylum seekers and how we talk about drug addicts. At face value, that could be an offensive comparison for some. What is the comparison you're actually making here?
Yes, yeah, I know it could be an offensive comparison, and I don't mean that, of course, at all. What I do mean is that there are striking parallels between the way in which, for a very long time, we have, and to some extent still approach the drug problem, and the question of asylum. So what I mean is that they're both characterised by overheated rhetoric, which blows problems out of all proportion, in relation to the global circumstances, for example. They're characterised by law enforcement strategies on the basis that the tougher we are and the higher the penalties, people will just stop it. But the problem with that attitude is that very often it's not true, and indeed in many cases it can make matters worse. We create systems of unintended consequences where our policies actually have the opposite results from what it is that we're trying to do. So we have this very counterproductive approach.
What are the similarities for you in how both drug addicts and asylum seekers, drug traffickers and people traffickers, get branded in the public domain?
Well, I mean, I think branding is exactly right. They're removed from all kind of individuality of personality, and they're characterised in either one of two groups, villains or victims. So the drug user, like the person who takes to the boats, is characterised as a victim, and we can treat them as harshly and viciously as we want because it's for their own good, which I'm sure is a bit of cold comfort for the people in those situations who, in relation to drug laws, for example, were and still are put in prison at enormously high rates for very minor kinds of offences because they need to be taught a lesson or because they should just say no. And the problem with the language of just say no in relation to drugs is that drug problems are not a function of drug use. They're an expression of deeper and underlying problems. And the same is true in relation to boats. The boats are not the problems. They're a symptom of underlying problems in the countries that lead to asylum flows and in transit countries like Malaysia and Indonesia. That's what drives people to the boats and drives people to Australia.
So a zero-tolerance approach, which was really at the core of early approaches to illicit drug control in this country, for you hasn't worked, it won't work.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it hasn't worked in relation to drug use. And in fact, it has made the problem worse. It's created more crime, more disease. It's driven people underground. It's created death. Those are not problems caused by drugs. They're problems caused by the legal response we've had to the drug problem. And you can see that in relation to a lot of our policies, which are still going on in relationship to asylum, where we continue to make matters worse. Mandatory detention, for example, has clearly made no difference to the number of peoples who come to Australia, whether we've put them in Christmas Island or Nauru or in Port Hedland or in any of those places. It's made life much worse, of course, for the people who we lock up for years at a time, even though they're innocent and claiming their legal rights, and it hasn't stopped the problem. Or if I can just give you one more quick example, the refusal of the right to work of people on bridging visas. Again, we have what I call legal magical realism, which is the assumption that if you make a law and say people can't work, then they won't work. But obviously, if they're only getting $30 a day, they will have to work. They will have to find ways to work. It's just that they'll do it under the counter. They'll do it illegally and will create an underclass. Again, we've had exactly the opposite result of what we've tried to achieve.
Well, you sound very confident. You sound very confident that what happened in response to a zero tolerance approach to drugs will happen in relation to a zero tolerance approach to asylum seekers. You can understand why people would believe, though, that if only the deterrence is severe enough, people, smugglers, asylum seekers, will change their behaviour.
Well, I think it's a very common attitude. I think it's an attitude that we very often have in relation to law. But the essential point to understand is that prohibition is not a kind of regulation. It's the opposite of regulation. It leaves the underground the reasons for behaviour completely untouched, and it leaves the underground market in relation to those things completely untouched. And the same has been true, and I know we'll want to say something about the PNG solution, but until at least the PNG solution, the same was true in relation to people smuggling cracking down. The result of cracking that down is to create greater profits for the people smugglers and to give them a greater incentive to have, you know, worse boats, to have cheaper people manning them, and to ratchet up the prices of it. So the result will be more dangerous craft on the seas and more people will die.
It's how do you exactly know that? What we saw. How do you know that for sure? I mean, if you draw the parallel with illicit drugs, you document how a zero-tolerance approach led to shadier dealing, riskier drug use, more tragic outcomes. Mm-hmm. I mean, people still maintain that zero-tolerance is the way to go for drugs, certainly politicians, perhaps not public health professionals.
No, I mean, and I think that's right. I think, you know, I know I'm being, pretty dogmatic about that, and the fact is that for 20 or 30 years we have very good evidence about the results of our legal structure in relation to drugs, and it's very clear to me that the zero tolerance approach hasn't worked. What has worked, and perhaps we can get to that in a moment, is what we call harm reduction, which is to actually try and address in a humane way the causes of drug problems, and that has led to health results that have been very impressive in relation to drug users and has, you know, lowered trafficking rates and all sorts of things like that. So we know that there's a better way, and we know that our legal system has done an appallingly bad job where it's taken this prohibitionist approach.
So now, zero top, go on.
I was just going to say, now your point is also, and you know, how do I know that that's also true in relation to the boats?
Indeed, and I agree, do you know that the asylum seeker policy will play out in ways that we won't predict with people smugglers?
Well, I think that it you know, I'm making a metaphor or an analogy here, and you're right, I'm making a supposition, so I can't be as dogmatic about that. But I think we again have evidence, for example, that mandatory detention and similar policies like that haven't worked, and you know, the refusal of the right to work is already making the problem worse. It's already snowing under our NGOs. It's already forcing people to work under the counter. We know that this is already happening. And if I give you one more example, a boat that sank off the coast of Christmas Island earlier in the year, two or three people died in that boat. They sank even though customs officials and customs boats got to them, because the people who were manning those boats were so inexperienced that they didn't know how to handle the boarding process. And it was in that boarding process that the people died. Why was that? Why were they so inexperienced? It's because it's part of the new breed of people who are being used because of the growing illicit pressures on the people smuggling business, which is forcing them or encouraging them to ratchet up their prices and lower their costs. So I think we are seeing a playing out of very similar patterns in relation to those kinds of stories as we have already seen over and over again to drugs.
It's a potent comparison you're making. Professor Desmond Manderson is my guest this morning on Life Matters. He's written a very pointed a polemic, I would say, in the coming Griffith Review. It's titled Groundhog Day, Why the Asylum Problem is Like the Drug Problem. Kevin Rudd, Des, has now delivered what you might describe as the ultimate zero-tolerance trump card with his announcement this week. No people will ever settle in Australia if they try and get here on boats. Surely that is a disincentive for people smugglers.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, this is a new policy and I have to be careful not to be sort of too categorical about what the results will
and
be.
And extend the metaphor into that whole brave new world.
Right, exactly. So you know, since Friday I've had to do some thinking about what I've been saying about these kinds of arguments. And I'd say, firstly, that a lot of our practices in relation to family reunion and work and mandatory, all of that continues to be true. I think that, you know, the Prime Minister is trying to do an end run around the convention. There are certainly legal problems and legal issues as to whether the approach that he's taken is actually legally sustainable. And we'll have to wait for the High Court to say whether that's the case.
Well, but what's your reading of that situation?
Well, my reading is that it's... I would be surprised if it was legal. I mean, I think it could be legal. But I think that the discrimination by the mode of arrival, the conditions under which they will be kept, you know, the basic test is whether Papua New Guinea is actually capable of providing effective refugee protection. The United Nations conclusion is that it isn't. So I think that if we're not entitled to send refugees who land on in our responsibility to places where there isn't an effective refugee regime. So it seems to me problematic that that's the case in Papua New Guinea.
You say that our approach to illicit drugs is more than a cautionary tale in relation to our approach to asylum seeker policy in Australia. And people, as you suggested, advocate for a so-called, you know, harm minimisation, harm reduction approach to drug use. So what would or what could a harm minimisation approach look like for asylum seekers?
Well, you know, the whole thing is if you step back from the new policy, from the Papua New Guinea policy, and step back from even the legal details, all the moral details from that reason as to whether this is a moral thing to do, the strategy is basically that to try and make Australia as much or worse than the Malaysian situation. In other words, what we're trying to do is spending about $5 billion a year to try and recreate on purpose the circumstances that Malaysia is suffering from by accident, which is a pretty bizarre kind of idea. The alternative approach would be rather than trying to make Australia like Malaysia, we should try and make Malaysia more like Australia. We should try and deal with the problems that are driving people from transit countries. So if we look at the Malaysian situation, we have over 100,000 Malaysian refugees and an additional 100,000 forced migrants. They're coming to Australia because the conditions there are unsustainable. There's no hope for most of them they will ever be resettled. They have no right to stay, no right to work, no right to education. If we want to change that, if we want to in fact encourage and expand the Refugee Convention and encourage Malaysia to sign the Refugee Convention rather than us abandoning it, in other words, work to improve conditions in Malaysia, then we have to deal with that problem, which clearly the Papua New Guinea approach is not. In fact, it's making a regional solution further away, more distant rather than better.
If you're continuing the parallel to drug dealing and the metaphor that you're developing, this is targeting the supply side of asylum seekers rather than the demand side,
so to speak.
That's right.
And you know, the reason that I think drugs is a helpful comparison is because the move from zero tolerance to harm reduction shows that we can change. It shows that we can shift the narrative or the rhetoric and move towards an approach which has done more good, as you say, the move to a supply side certainly, but also things like decriminalisation, needle exchange programs. These are areas in which Australia is leading the world. And what's heartening about that is that by respecting the agency and the dignity of drug users and trying to deal with their problems rather than to treat them as the problem, we're not just doing something that's morally nice, we're actually engaging in better public policy, which has had better outcomes. And that's what I'm saying is another helpful analogy here. If we shifted to a harm reduction approach, and I'll give you a couple of specific measures in a moment, by respecting the agency and the dignity of asylum seekers and not just treating them as the problem, we will not just be feeling better about ourselves, we will be actually helping to deal with the problems that are causing this symptom. You know, there was a famous line Arthur Kessler said at one point, the Phoenicians used to beat the waves to calm the storm. And that's what we're doing in relation to asylum. That's what we used to do in relation to drugs. Harm reduction attempts to deal with the storm and not the waves.
It's still, though, you're pointing to the fact that harm minimisation, it's not a fait accompli in Australia by any stretch. It's still considerably debated. I mean, as I mentioned, public health professionals advocate it for it. Politicians are less inclined to, because it's not seen as being tough enough. It's sometimes seen as endorsing drugs, and that's been, to a great degree, the concern around the asylum seeker issue as well, that you endorse you endorse asylum seekers coming by boats if you give them any concessions.
Well, I think we have to understand why they come. Right? It's not a matter of endorsing. It's about actually comprehending why it is that people are taking those moves. I agree with you that the political battle, and this is my point, the government doesn't face a moral dilemma. It faces a political dilemma because of the kind of rhetoric. And that rhetoric has been extremely harmful of actually thinking clearly. Now the one thing I will say is that I was away from Australia for about 10 years. I worked in Canada for
You're an ex-expat.
I'm an ex-expat,
looking
exactly.
at this whole issue as an ex-expat, which gives you an interesting perspective on it.
That's right. And you know, the point of the essay that I wrote was that when I came home, I was struck by the things that seemed to be stuck in Australian politics that were unchanged after 10 years, of which the language and the crisis around the boats was one of those. But I was also struck at one area in particular where it seemed to me the rhetoric had dramatically changed, and that was in relation to drug use. You don't get the same, you do get some of it, but you get much less of the sort of hysterical, overblown, lock them up and throw away the key kind of rhetoric that you got 10 years ago. Why has that happened? Now, I think there are two reasons why it's happened. One is that the cost of drugs and the appalling value for money that we get from zero tolerance approach is very widely understood and has been a real problem, not just for left-wing do-gooders, but for right-wing, you know, people who care about the bottom line. And that really forced people to rethink how we were spending our money in relation to drugs. There, the analogy with asylum is clear, that we're throwing billions of dollars at this kind of problem for very small results. And the Papua New Guinea solution, which, as far as I understand it, is just going to be, you know, a year at a time, and is going to spend us billions of dollars, and we'll see what kind of a result it can. But it's a temporary measure for vast amounts of money. Meanwhile, the amount of money we've been putting into UNHCR went down 13% between 2011.
Well, we still don't know the economics of an alternative approach, a harm minimisation approach that you're advocating either.
Well, I think it would be surprising if it cost as much as the $4 or $5 billion that it's costing us at the moment. But I think there was another very important element in relation to drugs, which explains the kind of shift in a lot of people's behaviour, including people who are, you know, very conservative and have very genuine concerns about things like drug use.
Well, and in some cases, parents who lost children to drugs seem to shift their story from one of zero tolerance to harm minimisation.
The more that we had a personal contact with somebody who was actually involved in drug use or drug abuse problems and had actually come up against the legal system, the more the language in which we described those people and the language in which we described the approaches we were taking seemed to bear very little relationship to that circumstance and to those problems. And as you say, it was a lot of people who had actually been hurt and suffered as a result of this, who thought, this is crazy, we can't go on. The question is not, what will the alternative approach be? The question is, could it possibly be worse or more counterproductive than the problem, than the way in which we're dealing with it now?
Desmond Manderson, I have no doubt that people will wrestle with the detail of this comparison that you're making, and I thank you for articulating it for us on Life Matters this morning. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Desmond Manderson, he's a professor. He's from the ANU College of Law, where he's a future fellow. He's back from some years overseas. And his essay in the forthcoming Griffith Review is called Groundhog Day, Why the Asylum Problem is Like the Drug Problem. I want to hear from you. about what you think of that comparison. Do you think it's a legitimate metaphor that he's developing there? Get on our Facebook page if you can. And our website, abc.net.au/radionational. Look for Laugh Matters and let it rip. Please do. You can email us or you can comment on any story. Our listener feedback line, 202-833-1430. So the carbon tax looks set to be axed. What does that mean?